BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
You see at the top of the pyramid, the eye. The eye is the reminder to everyone who sees it that we are everywhere. We see everything. There's nothing that we don't know.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Home Secretary Theresa May rages at the Tory conference, but is she a non-violent extremist herself, destroying centuries of freedoms? Not only that, for appointing the heads of three abuse inquiries into historical child sexual abuse in Whitehall and Westminster, all with links to the abusers. After this betrayal of vulnerable children by the Home Secretary, we ask tonight, we've imported many things from the United States, private healthcare, the Supreme Court, police commissioners, but what about child abuse? Echoes of the Leveson inquiry into phone hacking run by Lord Leveson, who is a personal friend of the Murdoch family. But will that tactic wash for child sexual abuse in Westminster and Whitehall? Her appointment of less than three individuals to head her child sexual abuse inquiries, that's Lady Butler-Sloss, Peter Wanless and now Fiona Wolfe, who also have connections to suspects in the very same civil service which is under investigation. Also, news the European Union has approved all the special subsidies for the new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point, near Bridgewater. Friends of the Earth's David Powell explains whether the deal is now really cut and dried. But first, Hong Kong. Similar street protests happened back in 2010 in Hong Kong, and London-based filmmaker Sam Weill was working in the former colony at the time. He made a film called Out of the Shadows, where local people told the story of Hong Kong's strange halfway house between dictatorship and democracy, and what they were doing about it. And I'm pleased to say Sam Wild, old mate, actually, is joining me on the phone right now. Sam, hi, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Oh, thanks, Tony. Nice to be welcomed onto your show, yeah.
Okay, just tell us about what put you in Hong Kong back in 2010, because I've seen your film, Out of the Shadows. It's absolutely fascinating insight into how it all works over there.
Thanks for that. Well, I went to Hong Kong in 2008 to work with a news agency there, and was working for them as a journalist. And in the course of living in Hong Kong, I started to kind of like document these little protests that were going on, and started to also get quite fascinated by the nature of the political situation there, the political system that they have. And just try to kind of get my head around it, exactly what Hong Kong, how Hong Kong's political system works, and that kind of, you know, as I say, down a rabbit hole. And over the course of time, I just got into making this documentary as I got more and more fascinated by what was going on in the city.
Okay, so where do we stand between the dictatorship and the democracy? Because really many people see China as a dictatorial kind of place. You know, I've certainly met many journalists from China. They don't really seem to have the public's best interests at heart. They seem very loyal to the party, for example. So where does Hong Kong stand between the two?
I like that, actually. I've never seen it like that, but heard it described like that. I think that's a good way of putting it, between democracy and dictatorship. But actually, I think, in a way, on a local level in Hong Kong, the dictatorship is less about China, though that is evidently a force that remains powerful, and a kind of a shadow is cast by China over Hong Kong. But the dictatorship that I think you can really talk about in Hong Kong is one where the corporate sector has a direct representation in the political system. By that I mean that groups such as the hotel and tourism sector, accountancy sector, the legal sector, all have seats that are actually representative of their interest in the government. So it'd almost be like if we had in the United Kingdom a seat that was basically elected for the hotel industry in the British Parliament, as well as the people who are actually genuinely democratically elected MPs.
Well, that, you know, that reminds me, Sam, of the rotten boroughs we used to have. We had certain seats in Parliament which was reserved, for example, just for a handful of people from the universities and this kind of thing, that there was no kind of universal suffrage. And it sounds to me as if their version of this inverted commas democracy that they've got in Hong Kong is maybe, you know, even a couple of hundred years behind the state of the art.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I'm careful of using the word behind because it makes it sound like there is a measurable way to look at the nature of democracies. I think really what's happened there is, if you're right, it's like the rotten boroughs. It's like those kinds of places that we used to have in the UK, where, as you say, people of a certain level of education, of a certain level of property ownership, for example, were only allowed to vote, and obviously women weren't allowed to vote either. Hong Kong still has that, but I think it's more about the fact that the corporate sector has always argued and been listened to that its voice is absolutely central and essential to the guidance of Hong Kong, and that without direct representation of business interests in the city's political system, the city wouldn't be able to cope, the city wouldn't be as successful as it is. But there are really direct negative consequences to having having powerful business interests in the political system.
Well, one of those is the fact that you've got an increasing amount of working poor, rather than like here in Britain, even though we do have the universal franchise here. So let's just have a little listen to a clip from your film Hong Kong, Out of the Shadows now.
Some people are living in very poor conditions in Hong Kong. These group of people are usually working poor households. The Hong Kong government always believed that in big market and small government, and also they always believe in the kind of a trickle-down thesis. That means if our economy can grow stronger and bigger, the resources and the wealth will trickle down to the bottom group of our people. But actually, I think the trickle-down thesis doesn't work. For the past so many years, we just find that the gap between the rich and the poor is getting bigger and bigger.
Now, I'm getting deja vu, Sam, because a lot of these things are exactly the kind of things we're talking about in Britain. How different, I mean, we've had, was it 15 years or so now, since, or maybe 20, I'm not sure how long it is, since Hong Kong separated off. But how similar is the Hong Kong society to British society, having lived there?
We just heard there that you played was a Tsang Ka Wai. My Cantonese isn't great. And she represents Oxfam. And what she was talking about was the failure of the, as she said, the so-called trickle-down effect. And that's something that's been argued very much in this country too, and is currently being argued by Osborne and Cameron, that if we don't have a powerful economy governed by and run for the needs of the rich, then without them as a motor for economic dynamism and change, there will be no possibility for people to become rich themselves. And in a way, as that's what you see in Hong Kong, and there's, like you say, I think it's just more extreme in Hong Kong, that's all. This whole idea that the rich will get richer and as a result their wealth will trickle down to the poor beneath them has been proved to be completely bankrupt, not only as a political idea, but certainly as an economic one. And there are comparisons. I think the situation in Hong Kong is just a bit more extreme. Like the UK, people won't starve to death in Hong Kong, and they do have a health service of sorts. But the nature of the welfare that is available to vulnerable people, be they elderly, be they disabled, be they jobless or whatever, is getting thinner and thinner. And the hardship is really intensifying there. And that's not just me saying that. That's like proved by the United Nations, the International Labour Organization's big NGOs that, you know, take time to look into the economic realities and indexes for poor people. And it's a struggle for people. both in Hong Kong and the UK, as you say.
Yeah, let's have a look, listen to another clip now. And this is really looks at the electoral system, because it is a bit confusing, but you do deal with it in the film. And I found it fascinating to see this kind of weird halfway house between it being run by big corporations and actually the people having a say too. So let's have a listen to another clip from your film, Hong Kong Out of the Shadows.
Universal suffrage, which means that everybody can vote for people in the legislature, is a tried and tested method in practically every country of the world. Why is it that it won't work in Hong Kong? No one has ever managed to satisfactorily explain this. What they say is, well, if you have that, you may elect the wrong people. Well, hey, yes, that's absolutely right. I can think of legislatures with the wrong people. What they also say is, but Hong Kong, and now we're getting closer to the bone, Hong Kong has certain very influential people whose interests have to be preserved, and I don't think we could ever actually get them elected, so the only way we can get them into the legislature is having special seats preserved for them, which nobody else can vote for except for these small elite groups.
We all believe in one man, one vote, directly elected legislators. They are accountable to each and every people in Hong Kong, but not the functional constituency's representative. We can see that we have so many badly performed legislators from functional constituencies. And in many, many occasions, their positions is totally against the interests of the people. Just make it simple. We want all the seats in LegCo to be directly elected.
Okay, so we had the rotten boroughs. They've got the functional constituencies. Ultimately, do you think that this system is going to be changed? I want you to look at, gaze into your crystal ball, Sam, and say how you think that these protests are going to go, having lived through those 4 years ago.
It's great, actually, to hear that you've really got your head around how these functional constituencies work. Not a lot of people do. I personally feel that is definitely a engineered design of the system to ensure that it is complex, arcane, and difficult to comprehend and therefore access and be involved in. The current protests at the moment are being presented as if they are only about the chief executive, and that is in part true. But that's a distraction, really, because the functional constituencies that make up 30 of the 70 seats, so there are 70 seats in their parliament, in effect, and 30 of them basically come from the corporate sector, that is in desperate need of reform. And many of the issues that are happening in Hong Kong, be it the increase in the price of property, low wages for people, an erosion of the welfare state, for example, are directly connected to the decisions that are taken by the parliament that is heavily stacked in favour of corporate interests.
Well, I noticed some of the protesters have been saying, it's a really interesting article in The Independent here this week, saying the freedom of Hong Kong is in Britain's hands and Cameron can only stay silent for so long. So what do you think the role of Britain is presently, Sam?
Well, it's interesting you bring it up, because I was talking to a young woman today as part of a story that I'm working on, and she said this really nice thing, which is that, what did she say here? If we had the choice, we'd have the UK rather than China. But we don't really love the UK anymore because they don't love us. She said it kind of tongue in cheek. But the reality is that actually Britain is obliged under the Sino-British Declaration, which allowed for Hong Kong to be slowly handed back to China, which happened in 1997 and is supposed to allow Hong Kong to be semi-independent for 50 years. Britain is actually obliged under that to maintain the independence of Hong Kong and to advocate for that in face of opposition, perhaps at times from China. But it doesn't take much to work out, really, that we know where this government's priorities are, and its economic, its economy is absolutely at the centre of it. And China's a massive client of the UK and has huge economic clout. So, surprise, surprise, the Brits aren't saying much, you know. But I don't think many people in Hong Kong really expect that from the UK, you know. A lot of Hong Kong, what's really interesting, where I feel like there's optimism to be taken from this, Hong Kong people, particularly younger, what they call post-80s generation, i.e. those born in after 1980, a lot of those people see themselves as Hong Kongers now. Not Chinese, not British, but actually as Hong Kongers. And that's where there's an identity which has created some, I think, and other people seem to think, you know, this kind of groundswell of youth-led resistance that's saying, you know, this is our city, we're going to fight for it, we're not going to just be kind of headlocked into doing whatever the Chinese want us to do, you know?
So Lord Paton, who was responsible for that Sino-British agreement, he was the last governor of Hong Kong, last British governor anyway. He accused Beijing this week of breaching its commitments to Hong Kongers made before the territory was returned to China in 1997. Lord Paton said Beijing was undermining the so-called One Country, Two Systems agreement, which affords the people of Hong Kong a degree of autonomy and freedoms not enjoyed by those in mainland China. The Chinese said these matters were within the autonomy of the Hong Kong government and they are now reneging on that. The Chinese said these matters are within the autonomy. I can't actually quite understand that. But anyway, this is Lord Paton's gobbledygook, I'm afraid. Anyway, he said also, finally, adding that there must now be a new period of genuine consultation over democratic reforms. Now, he's talking about consultation, but the people on the ground, the tens of thousands, want reform, don't they, Sam?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, it's a little bit disingenuous for someone like Paton to say that, to be honest, because it was the Brits who left the functional constituency system in place, which they began to introduce in the mid-80s. So, you know, it feels a little bit hypocritical, if I can go be so bold to say that.
Okay, and also, we've seen also that there have been some attacks on the demonstrators, haven't there? Peaceful demonstrations going on with umbrellas. Wonderful example, I suppose, of totally peaceful demonstrations, and yet some people have come in and attacked, and the police stood by and watched.
Yeah, I heard about this, and it's hard to know to what extent those people who've attacked the demonstrators are like perhaps agents provocateurs or paid stooges of somebody, or if they're actually locals who are saying like okay, that's enough, now we just want to get back on with business. I have my hunches, but I think, to be honest, from what I can see, the groundswell, the size, the numbers are really are currently on the protesters' side. But to what extent they can kind of maintain this momentum and keep up this drive is anybody's guess, really. And I can only hope that they do, because it feels to me like they have a just cause to fight here, and that the structural reforms that are needed for Hong Kong are well overdue.
I just want to wind up, Sam, by just saying, you know, why are the Chinese so nervous of this? Because we've already heard that 70% of their parliament is already elected by ordinary people. What would they stand to lose if the entire parliament was freely elected by the people, and that we completely got rid of this kind of preferential business seats? What are the Chinese and what are the Hong Kong business people fear?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not really sure. I'm not sure if the Chinese authorities are afraid of the idea that you have this kind of renegade democratic state that Hong Kong could become, and that it might kind of influence and spread its tentacles into mainland China, and that will then, you know, result in some kind of uprising. I don't know if they're afraid of that. I think in Hong Kong, maybe the business interests, you can say that business interests are kind of generally pro-Beijing in Hong Kong, if you like, but that's not really a correct reading of it. The business interests in Hong Kong, I think, are partly just a bit complacent. They feel it's their right to have political representation, for example. But without kind of getting too wild in my comparisons, I do think it's interesting to note that while in the UK we don't have a system that is as blatantly corrupt as that, we do have a situation in which, for example, example, large numbers of the cabinet all went to the same school or university, come from a similar background, are men, usually middle-aged and white. I mean, we all have systems that are in need of a bit of an overhaul, I think. And it's not that there aren't successful examples of alternatives. For example, Finland has over 50% of its MPs are women, which reflects its population, right? So, you know, everywhere it has its potential to be reformed in some capacity. And right now, it just seems that Hong Kong and that young group of people have managed to, through serendipity, bring it to a mass platform. Yeah.
Okay. Also, today we're hearing Hong Kong protests. This is in The Independent today. Demonstrators are in a vow not to be intimidated by hired guns. Allegations the Chinese authorities have bust in gangs of organised agitators to provoke violence and delegitimise the pro-democracy campaign have been gaining credence. So seems like you're not the only person to be thinking like that. Also, do you think anything's to be gained with the meeting with the chief executive, Sam?
I mean, in a way, you know, when a group of people set up a situation that has happened in Hong Kong, namely these young people and the protests that have been led there, eventually there's going to be a conclusion to it, right? And I don't know if they've set themselves up for a fall by demanding his resignation or by demanding that the government acquiesce and allow for any member of the public to stand in the election rather than the hand-picked candidates, which is what the current system is. You know, you're dealing with authorities who are not renowned both in Hong Kong and China for their capacity to negotiate. And any kind of, I mean, I don't like saying this because it's a generalization and it's a cultural stereotype, but there is an aspect of face in Chinese culture that is really, really important. And if this were done too quickly and too hastily and seemingly in response to the demands made by this student movement, there would definitely be seen to be a loss of face among those in the establishment, and that's definitely not part of their agenda. So I don't know. Who knows what the outcome will be, but it feels like it's window dressing at the moment by the authorities, you know.
Okay, Sam Wild, the filmmaker of only released more recently, but shot back in 2010, Hong Kong, Out of the Shadows. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show. And we'll go straight on to speak, actually, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers about this, because the geopolitical angle on this, Martin, I'm interested do you think the Chinese looking at Hong Kong and saying, well, maybe we've got another Kiev here, maybe there's this movement has been orchestrated, that kind of thing. What are your thoughts about how genuine this is, or potentially if there are people who actually have from outside Hong Kong and outside China that have an influence?
Well, I think the Chinese government are claiming that the demonstrators are being supported by the US State Department and the National Endowment for Democracy, and I'm afraid it's more than likely that they are. That doesn't mean that they're illegitimate thereby, but it's quite possible that there are those who want to make difficulties for the government in Beijing, and that doesn't mean that people in Hong Kong haven't got their own grievances about the situation there. It's potentially worrying because it's part of a trend towards conflicts around the world. What I would hope would happen was that, the suggestion that they should meet with the demonstrators and that they will meet with the deputy leader of Hong Kong. I think most people in Hong Kong would realise that they're not likely to get complete independence from Beijing, because Beijing, has got a very strong interest in the colony. And I think also in China, more widely, there is some sympathy for Hong Kong demonstrators, but there's also some resentment towards them, as they're seen as a rather privileged group and essentially helping China's enemies. So I think they need to think quite carefully about that in terms of how they present themselves to the rest of the Chinese population.
Okay, today we've heard there's been violent clashes there, but protesters are holding their positions. How do you think it's going to pan out in the next week?
Well, one would hope that everybody will show common sense. Protesters aren't going to go away, and the government isn't going to go away. Let's hope that some compromise can be reached, because the real danger is that something something bad will happen, which will lead, for example, to Hong Kong not being a stable stable place, and which means obviously will affect the economy. But as I say, the demonstrators need to think about how they are perceived in the rest of China, because they are relatively privileged compared to other Chinese, both economically and politically. So that doesn't mean they're in the wrong. It just means that they've got to bear in mind that others will be looking at them with some envy rather than with necessarily feeling supportive of them.
I think they've done an amazing job, actually. You know, tens of thousands of people all keeping peaceful despite a lot of provocation. Anyway, I'm joined in the studio now by David Powell from Friends of the Earth. We're going to start straight away with the China connection to Hinkley Power Station, because we've heard over the last couple of weeks, David, that the European Union, it looks like, are going to say, yes, it's okay to have these massive subsidies for the new nuclear power station there. So just tell us about that. What does that actually mean?
Yeah, so thanks, Tony. Good evening. Hello. So what it looks like, this isn't actually officially confirmed as far as I know. It might have been confirmed today. I haven't checked the latest. They want to build, EDF wishes to build a great big new nuclear power station at Hinkley, just down the road from here. To do that, they need a colossal amount of subsidy from the government. They need 35-year contracts. They need, how much is it, 17 billion worth of subsidy, I think, over that time. The only way they're going to get that is if the government gives them basically a very, very sweet deal. Greenpeace called it, our colleagues at Greenpeace called it the heist of the century. And so the European Commission had a look at it. And it was not at all clear for ages that the European Commission would give it the go-ahead. It looks like they have. It's been leaked. And it's quite interesting that it's been leaked, actually. I wonder what that tells us about the politics of nuclear in the European Commission. By no means is all of the European Commission in favour of nuclear. But it looks like, to cut a long story short, that it'll get a go-ahead. There'll be some tweaks to the level of profit that the EDF are allowed to make, but basically they'll still be able to get £92 per megawatt hour, which is twice the price, wholesale price of electricity at the moment, for 35 years, with the taxpayer picking that up. Now,
just let me stop you there, because yeah, you just said that the European Commission are deciding this. The European Commission aren't actually elected, are they? They're basically bureaucrats. So none of our elected people are actually making this decision. I find that a little bit concerning.
Yeah, well, so the UK elected government made the decision in the first place. There's European state aid laws, trading agreements, basically says if something looks like a government in any of the countries is doing something to give an unfair leg up to a particular industry, then the Commission has a look at it. And that is the rules, and the Commission are ultimately accountable to the Parliament, who are elected. But yeah, absolutely, it is European bureaucrats, if you like, that are having a look at this. And
but surely they are. I mean, it's quite obvious that they're saying we're giving you a leg up, and the European Commission is saying no, they're not.
Quite right. Yeah. In a nutshell, that's right. It's hard to see how one company being given an exclusive contract for 35 years won't even be built for 10 years, so until 2060, at a rate of electricity return twice what you actually pay for it at the moment, how that isn't a leg up. It looks like a massive leg up to us. It clearly is a subsidy. The issue is not whether or not it's a subsidy. The issue is whether the Commission think it's fair enough in the spirit of the law. Now, it's a big surprise to us that they think it's fair enough. And I tell you what, the people down in Stop Hinkley, down protesting near where I live, down in that area, they're not going to give up easily. The likes of Greenpeace and the people out there really campaigning for it aren't going to give up easily either. And I understand that already there's talk of an appeal back to the European Commission saying you can't be serious.
Before they've officially announced it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Wonderful. Well, we had Louise Somerville-Williams here on this show from Frack Free Somerset last week. And last Friday, we had the pretty shocking announcement that 99% of people are saying they don't want fracking law changed under their homes, and yet the government are going to change it anyway. Is that true?
Pretty much. It depends. What actually happened was this. So the government's decided it's going to change the law to make it... at the moment, if someone wants to come and frack under your house, you know, fracking is extremely high-pressure water chemicals injected up 2 or 3 miles under the ground to force gas out. At the moment, if they want to do that under your house, they have to get your permission. Clearly, if you want to do fracking on a big scale in this country, which the UK does, that's an awful lot of permission to get. So they're proposing changing the law so that they don't have to get permission, to cut a long story short. And they consulted, did one of those legendary government consultations on basically saying, we've decided to do this thing, now what colour do you want the hats that the builders are going to wear to be? 99% of people that responded to the consultation, which was something over 30,000 people, said, hang on a minute, Gov, we don't even want you to be doing this in the first place. And the government basically said, well, that's not what we were asking about, and completely ignored it. And so the 1% of people that were left, well, essentially, those people said, yes, fine. And, of course, those people were overwhelmingly, if not entirely, from industry or business or people who have a vested interest or otherwise in getting fracking happening. 24% of people, Tony, less than a quarter of people in this country, if you ask them, say they support fracking. A lot of other people are undecided, but what there is nowhere near is the support the government needs. And if they had have got out and actually asked that question to people, do you think you should be able to have the ground under your home fracked without your permission, you know what people would have said? They would have said no, get bent. And what they're having to do time and time again is ask detailed consultations about, we're going to give tax breaks to fracking, what colour pens should we use to fill it in with, how big should those tax breaks be? They're not interested in finding out or asking more broadly whether people want fracking, because they don't, and there's no mandate for it in this country, and the protests are just getting bigger.
Crikey. Martin, what's driving this? I know you said last week you think it's just a bubble. It's, they're saying, look, come and invest in this, we'll make a few bob on it, and then the whole thing will collapse.
Well, William Engdahl in the US is saying that it's basically to do with quantitative easing, and that if the quantitative easing wasn't happening and the basically the bubble economy being created in the financial sector, fracking wouldn't be at all viable. Don't forget, oil prices are in fact falling at the moment as a result of falling demand and various other factors. So I think probably it won't happen, because when the financial bubble bursts, fracking will no longer be a viable business. But of course, by that stage, those who've bought into the bubble and sold out at the right moment will have made their profits.
Yeah, and I think that's right, actually, Martin. And I think you might get a bit of it, but the finance industry are looking at this and increasingly going, I'm not sure I'm gonna be part of this. In America, the way it's working is you frack a well, and after a couple of years, you have to go find another one. And the whole thing's becoming a big Ponzi scheme where the financiers are always being paid off by the next well. But at some point, those wells are going to run dry. And indeed, they're running dry in three of the four main areas in the US. And if you add on to that the risk that's caused by people getting up and protesting and spending their entire weekends putting on demonstrations against this all over the country, well, it doesn't look particularly attractive, and I can't see it happening big time in this country.
What Louise was saying last week, David, was that some of the companies that have got these fracking deals, contracts or whatever they are, they're actually just like one person and their wife working out of a shoebox, and they don't actually have any assets. So this doesn't give me the greatest confidence this is going to happen. What's your prediction in a year or a couple of years' time? Is there going to be fracking widespread? And apparently the Mendips is one of the key areas of the country which has got this shale gas.
Yeah, the Mendips is in their sights. Actually, it's not just us down there. There's a map that Friends of the Earth have got. If you go to our website, foe.co.uk, you can put your postcode in and you'll find out where they want to frack. And there's some lucky people in the UK that don't live in a fracking area, but most of it is. We're getting past the stage of test drilling and exploratory drilling, and we're now into the stage where quadrilla are actually applying to actually frack. And up in Lancashire, we had the first vote a couple of weeks ago where the council have said no thanks. So the first actual application to do some actual fracking in this country has been rejected by council up in Lancashire. We haven't had that down here yet. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that gets rejected as well. I've got no doubt on a case-by-case basis it'll happen in some places in the UK. But the amount of opposition is extraordinary. People just don't want it. They don't want the truck movements. They don't want the pollution. They don't want their water under risk. They're just not interested.
Okay, the incredible thing is you actually got the sort of Daily Mail reading, homeowning audience also saying, what on earth do you think you're doing fracking under my home? I'm not going to allow this. And we had the Conservative MP Jacob Rees-Mogg on this programme a few weeks ago also saying that he had severe doubts about this idea of actually taking away people's private property rights that have been there since the year dot.
Absolutely, and this is what you... It takes something, actually, for Jacob Rees-Mogg and me to agree on something, but that goes to show, doesn't it, really? If you look over in the US, our politicians here are looking at the US, and they're looking enviously at the amount of fracking they've got going on there. As just discussed, the economics don't necessarily stand up, but the reason they've got loads of fracking is no one lives there, relatively. Most of it is empty. You can cover acres and acres with densely populated fracking rigs, and no one minds. Not only that, the way that their property works is different. so that they don't... It's not the same situation over here where you have to approach people first to get their permission. We can't do that over here. We don't have the space, and our laws work differently. And if the only way you're going to get fracking anywhere like that sort of scale is to do it whether people want it or not. And as we've seen, you know, people don't.
OK, on to another subject, and this is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, something which is a little bit obscure, largely because it's secret. And for those that want to have a listen to a longer interview in it, I've spoken to a woman from... Linda Corsha from Stop TTIP, and that programme will be on Monday morning here on BCFM at 11 a.m. But ultimately, what's Friends of the Earth's view on this? Because we have been told very, very little about it by the London media because it's so secret. And I find it very strange that a massive trade deal is allowed to be negotiated in secret. So, for example, we don't know which clauses are going in, which clauses are going out, and what stage the negotiations are. Why is Friends of the Earth concerned about TTIP as well?
Yeah, so we're opposed to TTIP, and we should probably take a bit of a step back and say what's really going on here. So this is a proposal on the table between the European Union and the USA for a free trade deal. There's no such thing as free trade, a freer trade deal. And what it proposes to do is to get rid of differences in regulation between the two blocks. So a lot of the examples they use are fairly benign sounding things like, well, different car safety standards. Why have a red light on American cars and a white light on European cars, for example? Stuff like that, you know, I don't really mind if they change stuff like that. But then you look into it and you see, no, what they're talking about here is bringing regulations together where we have phenomenally different regulatory regimes. So chemicals, for example. In the European Union, there's a principle of law which says if you're not sure if something is dangerous or not, you ban it first and then you find out if it's dangerous. In the US, it's exactly the other way around. So over there, you have to prove something is dangerous rather than proving that it's safe.
Okay, so how many people have to die before a chemical gets banned in the US?
I'm not exactly sure of that. I know that over here, 1,300 chemicals are banned, and in the US, it's about 13, I think, which kind of tells you the difference. Now, what they tell us is that bringing these regulations together will not harm environmental standards, will not harm people. I don't see how you can bring two regulatory regimes like that together without something giving. Same goes for fracking, which we've talked about. We've talked about the differences in the laws in America and the laws over here. We've talked about in previous stuff, we talked about GM, Tony, when I've been on here before. All of these things where there are big differences, and it's not all one way either. One of the things I know Martin will be interested in is financial services. The US doesn't want banks and finance to be in this deal because it doesn't want the shoddy rules that we've got over here. Incredibly deregulated finance. It doesn't all work one way. The reason why it's all secret is because each one of these is phenomenally controversial. Vince Cable, who's the business secretary, says, well, it has to be secret because you don't reveal your poker hand too early. You don't show your hand. And even if I could be satisfied as Friends of the Earth, even if they could say to us, look, all of these things are absolutely fine, there is no problem, don't worry. Here's what's really going on, and here's the big issue. This is a deal for big business, by big business, cooked up in secret, where it's more weight on the scales in favour of people who don't want regulation and less weight on the scales for people who do. I don't want regulation for the sake of it, but I do want regulation to protect our environment and to protect people. And this is more and more and more weight on the side of people who don't. And that's the direction we're going in. And ultimately, that's why we've got to stand against it.
I would recommend, highly recommend, if anyone wants to, for professional reasons or just for curiosity, to have a good old look at this TTIP and what we do and what we don't know about it, recommend War on Wants report done by their director John Hillary. It's called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, a charter for deregulation, an attack on jobs, an end to democracy. Martin, that's a pretty strong claim for the final claim there, that it's actually going to end democracy. But what he's actually saying is that it's going to mean that big corporations are going to be able to sue national governments. So when the national government is elected, maybe even on an important issue like nuclear pollution or something like that, they get elected to do something. When the government then tries to legislate, the corporations are going to take them to court and sue them.
Well, that's right, and as has been pointed out, the regulatory regime has evolved in Europe as a result of competing pressures from various groups. And if you just overnight completely change the regulatory regime, that is not democratic by any stretch of the imagination. And I think it's interesting that Eurosceptics, for example, I'd be interested in what UKIP's position on this is. I understand that they are in favour of TTIP, which I find rather extraordinary, because if the Americans force the EU to accept this trade regulation, then surely they can accept it as well. Are they accepting it? I mean, we don't want to be told what to do by Brussels. Brussels is told what to do by Washington, and then Brussels tells Britain what to do, and that's all right then, isn't it? Or something, I don't know.
Okay, David, just to give us an idea of how people can kind of stay in touch with Friends of the Earth, and I wonder if you've got any kind of public events coming up to do with any of these subjects like TTIP or fracking.
Yeah, we do. So we've just, Bristol Friends of the Earth, who are the local group, have just organised an event, and it's going to be on the 8th of November in the Wells Memorial Building in Bristol. Pretty big event. All the MPs from the Bristol area, I think, are speaking there. Cross party. I think it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but the best thing to do is to go to the website at www.foe.co.uk, have a look on there, give us a call 0207 490 1555, or just have a search for Bristol Friends of the Earth and TTIP and all the things we've been talking about, and you'll find us in no time.
Okay, can you just give us the dates? I know you're not quite sure about the time, but when's that happening?
Well, I'm reasonably, I know the date is the 8th of November. I'm 99% sure it's 3 p.m. You can get tickets are free, and you can get hold of them online.
Okay, and the 8th of November is a Saturday.
That's right.
In a few weeks' time, David Powell from Friends of the Earth Southwest and nationally, I suppose we should say as well. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Thanks, Tony.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
And now back to this story from the top of the hour, which was Theresa May's failure to deal with any of the problems that there's been in the three people she's appointed to do child abuse inquiries. And let's actually start, though, by having a listen back to July this year, when former Conservative cabinet member Norman Tebbit, and I believe he was also chairman of the Conservative Party as well, had some pretty strong words to say about historical abuse within Whitehall and Westminster and the Tory party of children.
Most people would have thought that the establishment, the system, was to be protected. And if a few things had gone wrong here and there, that it was more important to protect the system than to delve too far into them. Now, that view, I think, was wrong then, and it is spectacularly shown to have been wrong, because the abuses have grown. It was almost unconscious. It was the thing that people did at that time. You didn't talk about those sort of things.
And at this stage, I really ought to say that any listeners of a fragile disposition or children really should maybe consider switching off, because this is a pretty harrowing stuff to deal with. And that, in a way, Martin, isn't it, is one of the ways that this has been kind of avoided. It's because it's a very, very difficult issue. And so Theresa May didn't talk about it in her speech this week.
No, because it's very embarrassing for the establishment, as Norman Tebbit just pointed out. And whenever we discuss things like this, I always point out that there is a very strong smell that the paedophilia at the highest levels is often linked to blackmail and the use of intelligence work to try and achieve certain political goals. What? So the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland was being used by MI5. The loyalist paramilitary leaders were being entrapped by having sex with the young boys there. And, of course, the boys themselves were not being protected. They were being used as bait in a wider game.
Well, the other horrifying...
I suspect that this may have been going on at the top in Britain as well.
OK, well, one of the other horrifying sides of all of this is Jimmy Savile's close association with the NSPCC, for example,
yep.
And the BBC, who one might expect to be doing investigative documentaries on child abuse. So what do you think about this whole aspect of people who are abusers actually hiding in some of the institutions that are there to protect children?
Well, if you think about it, if you're a serial abuser like Jimmy Savile, being very closely connected with the NSPCC makes an awful lot of sense, doesn't it? The De Trieu affair in Belgium also showed that basically when paedophilia is happening at the highest levels, it is used as a means of political control. So it's not just a question of oversight and lack of understanding. There's actually quite a conscious policy to use these things to blackmail politicians.
Well, the key thing about a sexual abuse inquiry linked to Westminster and Whitehall would be if those who are running those inquiries were trusted by those who were abused. One of the people who has been put forward is Michael Mansfield. Mansfield QC as a possible person, but no, Theresa May is not interested in him. She's appointed Lady Butler Sloss, whose brother, I believe it was Attorney General at the time this abuse was believed to have been going on. Also, Peter Wanless is looking at another a shorter inquiry, which is to find why all of the evidence which was handed to Leon Britton when he was Home Secretary disappeared. Peter Wanless has been very difficult on the internet, for example, trying to mislead people into thinking that Peter Mandelson wasn't involved with the NSPCC when he was. Certainly not the sort of person that most abusers would, I would imagine, trust. Also, now Fiona Wolf has been put in charge of the wider inquiry after Lady Butler Sloss stepped down, but she has links to Leon Britton, who's another person who's been named as a possible suspect.
Yes, and I understand the Paedophile Information Exchange's offices were, in fact, in the Home Office at one stage. We're not getting to the bottom of this, but as I say, it is a question about child abuse, but when you're talking about elite child abuse by people at the top of the chain, there's other factors involved, and in other words, the cover-up may not just be accidental.
Anyway, we take a different attack tonight, looking at the Franklin cover-up in the United States, because this has been actually very well documented in the US. There were some really hideous ritual abuse rings over there. And we ask, is organised child abuse by people in the public eye just another unwelcome import from the United States? The testimony we're going to start to hear now is from a guy called David Schurter. He was a US ritual child abuse sacrifice in America interviewee by a group over there online, and I'll put some links on after the show onto our website www.thisweek.org.uk. And he says that the abuse rings in the United States would take you to the edge.
What I remember is being connected and having electrode things stuck on my temples and getting electricity through it. But they used a lot of electricity. They used somewhat like cattle prods. My sister was the one who told me they liked to bring people to the edge of death and then bring them back and then take them to the edge of death again and then bring them back.
Yeah, I suppose this is the sort of stuff we would never really see if it wasn't for the internet. And I would again warn people that anyone of a nervous disposition or youngsters would really shouldn't be listening, so please switch off. But anyway, he also mentioned that there were in his ring that he says he was to do with child catchers. This is almost like something from old Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which I can remember being quite scared by as a child, written by Ian Fleming, of course. And these rings really were serious, and that some of the abuse took place in a Freemason's temple.
As a child, I didn't know who they were going to murder, but looking back as an adult, I realized that they always did. And so you would be hiding in this house for your life, and they would be catching people and torturing kids, and you could hear the kids screaming. Now, people would say, you know, in a neighborhood, a residential neighborhood, wouldn't you hear? No, you wouldn't. Because the house that this was all happening in was Alan Bear's old house. There's all kinds of secret passageways and areas that don't make sense and walls that don't make sense and all of that. And it is a very prestigious neighborhood full of huge old mansions with a lot of property around them.
So you thought that this was a funeral parlor. What made you think that at the time?
Because of the activities that were going on at Forest Lawn Cemetery that I did remember for a fact. There is a chapel that was built in Forest Lawn Cemetery by the Freemasons. And I distinctly remember child sacrifices happening in that chapel. I remember having to play hide and seek and being in the crematorium downstairs, because the crematorium is below the chapel. And a tunnel leading out to the woods, which was a graveyard. The crematorium was used highly, and so they would just be cremated, and the ashes would be put into the graves with other people. A lot of the people, a lot of the children, found their resting spot in a place. My mother always called it Babyland. I went to Forest Lawn. I've only been there twice.
This is Forest Lawn in Omaha, Nebraska, as opposed to any other Forest Lawn.
Right, Forest Lawn Cemetery in Omaha, Nebraska.
That's the voice of David Schurter there. Now, Martin, for many people, they'll think, surely child sacrifice doesn't go on today. But, I mean, we can't verify what he's saying here. But one of the points he makes is that actually by talking about this, people are able to actually themselves possibly talk.
Well, yes, I mean, allegations are allegations, and we've got to keep a sensible approach to that. But on the other hand, the fact that child abuse goes on is incontrovertible, and I would also suggest that it is used as a tool by political fixers, if you like, to get things that they want. I mean, if you have an affair with somebody not your wife, or even if you, as happened with the Tory MP who sent a picture of himself on social media to somebody, it's not a major crime to do such things. But of course, child abuse is, and of course is recognised by the society as an unacceptable practice, which means that those who are engaged in it or who are encouraged to engage in it are then open to blackmail by political opponents and friends and all the rest of it.
This case this week of the Tory MP who was entrapped in that way, he was actually asked 7 times before he sent this revealing picture of himself. You have to think to yourself, well, actually 6 times he said no. So at what point does it become entrapment?
Well, I mean, in that particular case, I think you could say that it was entrapment. But, I mean, the fact is that people are people in positions of authority of any kind are open to being abused, or are open to being they're open to carrying out abuse, and they're open to themselves being blackmailed. And I come back to the Kinkora Boys Home scandal, which is very clearly MI5 were running the Kinkora Boys Home as a place to entrap their political enemies and blackmail them thereby. And it's all well known in Northern Ireland, and I think that this is the kind of thing that has been going on at the top, possibly in Westminster.
Okay, Martin, we're going back to listen to David Schurter, Schurter, and his testimony, US Ritual Child Abuse and Sacrifice in America. And he explains it all started very, very young with children who were going to their preschools.
And, oh, the preschool in the Presidio was right in San Francisco. That was right in San Francisco.
Very young children coming home with venereal diseases.
Yes. From all of the preschools, actually. People talk about McMartin like it was just one preschool. But what most people don't realize is that there was a little over half a dozen preschools in the area that were saying the same thing. And what was happening was that the children were coming home and relating stories about murdering animals, having animals murdered in front of them, being sexually abused. And they had something called the False Memory Foundation, which came forward, which was designed by a family of accused pedophiles. And that's who set up the False Memory Foundation. And they all came through and said, you know, these are all false memories. Well, I'm not quite sure how they are false memories when your child's coming home with gonorrhea and STD in their anuses. I call them the False Memory Pedophile Protection Squad. They're designed to actually quiet and silence survivors and protect pedophiles. As far as I'm concerned, that's all the False Memory Foundation does, is silence the victims and promote the pedophiles.
And one might well ask, why would David Schurter get involved in something like this? But the fact of the matter was that his parents were actually encouraging it in some way. It was part of a sort of a generational cult that he was involved in. And also, the whole point of it, he was apparently, as a youngster, groomed, so-called, through vanity to become the Antichrist, one of many. But the idea was really to get them to commit evil deeds, the children, from a very, very early age, with under the promise of riches. But anyway, here is where David Schurter talks about the whole point in what he's saying and why he's come forward.
Did they ever define for you what they meant when they told you you were going to be the Antichrist? Did they get specific about what that meant?
To me, it was supposed to be something to actually be proud of and be excited about. I was told that I would be able to do whatever I wanted. It would, you know, allow me to have riches. Picture everything that Satan would say to you and try and ply you with to get you to turn over. And that's what they did. It was supposed to be this great thing, this wonderful thing. I was going to take over power and live forever. And I, as a child, fought against it. I think that my love for God really did save me. And I went through a huge period of years and years and years of my adult life trying to find any way out of being the whole Antichrist thing because I loved God.
So you felt chosen, like an evil version of Neo in The Matrix, kind of.
Right.
And that would be confirmed by other adults around you treating you as if that were true.
People ask me all the time how I survived the chaos and survived what happened as a child. And I tell people all the time that what saved me was God. God had a hand in my life from the very beginning. I'm not Christian per se, but I do love God. And I've read the Bible over and over and over. I found the Bible to give me quite a bit of comfort as a kid. I'm glad that we're getting this out, not because, you know, it's graphic, but because it's important for people to realize who have experienced this, that you're not alone. You're not alone. Other people have gone through it. They have survived. We're all starting to come together as groups now. Social media has allowed us to actually group together. I think that a lot of people who go through this are trapped in their own past and their own memories of the past and the trauma that went through.
That was David Schurter, and of course, if you know anyone or you have been in that sort of situation, please do go and talk to the authorities and the police about it. Anyway, thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Bristol East MP Kerry McCarthy. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. We'll have links to that and many other items on the show. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. The elderly father of a British man being held by Islamic State's trying to contact the group in a video appeal. Photojournalist John Cantley was seized in Syria in 2012. The men, who police say have confessed to killing two British tourists in Thailand, have reenacted what happened. Anna Jones reports.
Surrounded by police and dozens of onlookers taking pictures, the two Burmese migrants were taken to the beach on Koh Tao, where the bodies of Hannah Witheridge and David Miller were found nearly 3 weeks ago. Both were in handcuffs, wearing helmets and what looked like stab vests. After being paraded in front of the media, they were forced to show officers where and how they killed the tourists, with actors playing the roles of Hannah and David. The pair faced charges of murder, rape and theft.
An 18-year-old has been jailed for life for strangling his pregnant girlfriend with a scarf. Aston Robinson will spend at least 14 years behind bars for the murder of Kayleanne Palmer in Cheltenham in April. The Conservatives want to stop British laws being overruled by the European Court of Human Rights if they win the next election. The Justice Secretary, Chris Grayling, says Parliament should have the final say. A drug which can reduce people's dependency on alcohol could be used on the NHS in England and Wales. It'll be offered to people who drink the equivalent of half a bottle of wine a day, along with counselling. Stephen Orker's been taking the drug.
At its worst, I was probably on a couple of quadruple whiskies a night. But socialising, you get carried away so easily. Before you know it, you've had a whole bottle or two bottles of wine. This tablet, taken before the first measure of alcohol, completely removes the pleasure. And it did that exactly for me.
In football, Dundee United could go 5 points clear at the top of the Scottish Premiership tonight if they beat Kilmarnock. Blackpool take on Cardiff in the Championship. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.